Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, the 17th of July, and in Quinnia Creek side this morning is Mark Wilhelm's session called The Unresolved Search for a Public Theology, number 99-9. Let's listen in.
What I've been talking about all week is a presumption that people out there really do want the churches to step up to the plate and be a more active participant in our democracy. What this morning's topic is about is some evidence I have to undergird the argument I've been making that, in fact, people in general in our society do, in fact, want the churches to take a more active role and to adopt the kind of public theology that I've been advocating. And what I have in front of me is the draft of a report that will be published this fall, probably. Should have been published this June, and then it should have been published this August. My bet is, since I haven't been able to read the blue lines from the printers yet, that'll probably be like late September, maybe it'll get issued, something like that. But I think it provides some very helpful preliminary evidence on the basis of extensive interviews that large segments of the important leadership of our nation, political, business, social, civic leaders, philanthropic, we tried to hit all the categories, higher education, and so on, do in fact hope. First of all, they identify that religious leaders and institutions, or as we say these days now, faith-based institutions, to use a generic term, getting it away from specifically Christian language, that faith-based institutions should take a more active role. They regret that they don't, and they have some ideas about what that should be. So let me briefly tell you about this and get your reaction to what they had to say. Here's what we did. Back in the first half of 1998, we put together at Auburn Seminary through the study center that I'm associated with, four researchers who went to four cities. We sent two people into each city for about a week to interview a cross-section of leaders in all these sectors that I mentioned who would spend a half hour with us. You furrowed your brow. Why did you furrow your brow? Nothing? No, I thought it didn't. I thought that sentence was very clear.
It was clear. Oh, that's good. Why I'm telling you. I'm not even going to say why. I'll tell you later.
Oh, okay. Well, don't do that in a small group. You can make a whole. That's why as much as I liked when I was in school and college or seminary or in doctoral study, as much as it was great being in small classes, you had to plan it strategically. You know, you didn't want too many of them, because if it's a small class, you're on every day. You cannot get away with showing up and not being fully prepared, because there's no way you can hide in the sea of 100 people, you know, like in Bio 21, you know, 150 in the lecture auditorium. It doesn't matter if you've got the whole assignment read for that day, but boy, in the seminar with six of us, you're on the line, so there'll be no arched eyebrows in this session, unless you really mean it. Over about 4 months, four researchers, four cities, we selected the towns to try to get a geographic distribution in the United States. We didn't include Canada in this one, because there are too many differences in some structures. Geographic distribution, distribution in size of the town, distribution by what's perceived at least to be the public significance of the public presence of religion in the towns. And because our concern is specifically theological education, the varying degrees of the presence of theological schools. So we went to Portland, Oregon, where we're in the Pacific Northwest, where the public presence of religion is perceived to be weaker than in other parts of the country. Portland always reports a lower church attendance rate, or the Northwest reports the lowest church attendance rate, that sort of thing, in the nation. But Portland is also a place where there is, again, for our specific concern as a study center, a very prominent, regionally prominent Roman Catholic seminary and a very regionally prominent conservative evangelical seminary in the Portland region, not directly in the city of Portland. We went to Atlanta, Georgia, where you have a major regional hub, a larger metropolitan area than Portland, and a very important regional hub of the New South, a city on the make, as they say, with in an area where going to church is very important. But it also had major theological institutions largely associated with the mainline Protestant and African-American traditions, very large schools, including one affiliated with a major university, Candler School of Theology at Emory. But it also had a denominational affiliation. Candler is still a major supplier of United Methodist clergy in the Southeast. Bump into a Methodist minister in the Southeast, he went to Candler or she went to Candler, most likely. Then we went to Indianapolis, Indiana, to get into the Midwest, a smaller city, but where there is a very, very, very close relationship between classic American Protestant culture and the city. Even institutions, it's very much of a place where, in contrast to Atlanta, where it's you're in the South and religion sort of imbues things, in Indianapolis, all the old kind of structures of sort of church and community and stuff really live in a kind of classic American Main Street Protestant way, and undergirded by religiously affiliated institutions with lots of money, in particular the Lilly Endowment, which pours tons of money into the city of Indianapolis, and particularly the churches, and undergirds all of what goes on there, religious-based, because old Eli Lilly was a good Protestant, and he wanted his money to keep that ethos alive in Indiana, and Indiana Protestantism has its own endowment on the side. It's called the Lilly, its own foundation. And then we went to Shreveport, Louisiana, to go to a place where old-style Southern religion really lives, and there is no theological school. That's the main reason we went there. We wanted to get the interface of that and see, because we wanted to measure to what extent presence or absence of theological institutions impacted public perceptions of roles. For just coming in, this is a report on a study that undergirds the argument I've been making all week that the churches should step up to the plate and take a more active public theology, develop more of a public theology and take a more active role in our culture. And I've discussed ways I thought the churches should do that, but this study supports my assertion by providing some argument that the public out there in fact regrets the absence of religious leadership stepping up to the plate, and the ideas of how we might in fact be doing that, or what they think about what we should do. The report is called Missing the Connections, because that's sort of how it came across, that religious institutions and leadership were in fact missing the connections. And let me just summarize for you some of the things that the folks told us.
You know, Mark, based on this stuff, I'd be interested to know where folks in here are from.
Oh yeah, that is a good idea.
Kind of to see what perspectives we each bring to these kind of things.
Well, sure. So, where are you from? Anybody not from the Pacific Northwest?
Are you all from the Pacific Northwest?
I'm from
New York.
I'm originally from New York.
Really?
Yeah, for the past 20 years ago, I came from Tucson, Arizona. Previous to that, I was from New York.
Oh, okay. Where did you grow up in New York?
Just outside New York City, Westchester County.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Up the Hudson.
Minneapolis.
Anybody else?
Tacoma area.
Tacoma,
Seattle.
Same?
Yeah. Port Angeles.
The Port Angeles crowd, yeah, right. That I knew. Yeah, so nobody from Shreveport, or Atlanta, or Indianapolis, or Portland, Oregon, so... You know, I can tell stories and you guys can't deny, you can't tell me we're wrong. That's great. Good. That's the real reason I wanted to know when Laura suggested it. it would be interesting though if those of you who live in the Pacific Northwest think that fits, because we did come out here. There are those who have suggested that we need to go to like Minneapolis and Boston and a few places where they think that what we have found in these four cities, which does, as I've said, support the fact that public leaders think that religious leaders are missing some connections they need to be making, that in places like Minneapolis, St. Paul, where there is still a strong, perceived to be strong religious leadership affecting community issues in some way. I don't know if you'll be interested here if you think that. Or in Boston where the Roman Catholic Church, or in Chicago where the Roman Catholic Archbishop still plays a key role in certain public formation issues, whether there are some exceptions. We think that might be the case and we may need to study some exceptions. But we tend to think that they would be, and that generally speaking in the U.S., what we found in this study would in fact be the case. Here's what we did find. In all four of these communities, we were told that the focus of most faith-based institutions is, and this is the phrase we heard over and over again, the focus of institutions is they take care of their own. Some provide emergency aid to those who are not their members, people would hasten to say. And there are a few that heavily invest in that work. But for the most part, religious leaders and institutions are perceived as generally not being involved in civic life. The major exception is when faith-based institutions see their privileged positions in society being threatened. And this particularly came to us from community development leaders and political leaders who had experience with recommended changes in the tax codes locally being raised. I think I mentioned at one point this week some folks in Decatur, which is a town just outside of Atlanta, suggested that maybe all churches should participate in the tax that was being added to the community for recycling. That they thought that, yes, the churches would still be exempt from water and sewer and exempt from taxes for sanitation pickup or wouldn't be required to privately contract with, as most institutions are, the public trucks don't come around and pick up the trash. You have to get a commercial contractor to take your trash out. Wouldn't be required to do that. But that they could kick in this minimal amount to help get the recycling. They thought maybe the churches would like to actually support this. And the religious leaders generally never came to public hearings for other issues, but they showed up for the public hearing on this one and vociferously opposed the addition of the churches to the tax roll in any way on First Amendment grounds. And of course, the commissioners of that county immediately acknowledged that they would do that, but they just hoped that they would kind of voluntarily agree to pay this one, but no such luck. So beyond sometimes provide the emergency relief stuff, and beyond showing up when their privileges were being threatened, they thought that, for the most part, religious leaders were not involved. Seminaries in particular were also perceived as not being involved in the sense of being public assets in any way. They were schools, but they often weren't even acknowledged as being there. They weren't thought of as being educational assets or cultural assets. Even the least prominent community college was more well known and more actively perceived as being a cultural and educational asset to the community than were the seminaries. One president related a story of a seminary, related the story where he went to some kind of reception, public reception he was going to as a supposedly a leader in the community. He had been invited by somebody, and a woman asked him what he did. And he said he was president of such and such seminary. And she said, "Oh, where is that?" And he said, "Well, it's on such and such a drive. The seminary and the road have the same name." And she said, "Are you sure?" He said, "Well, yes, I'm sure." And she said, "Well, I've driven by there for 20 years, and I had no idea it was there." And the rector of a Roman Catholic school, rector is the same thing as president in the Catholic tradition, was flying into Washington for something, I suppose to go to a national conference meeting. National Conference of Catholic Bishops meets in Washington. While at the airport in Washington, he encountered the member of Congress from his district, and the rector recognized the congressman and introduced himself. And the congressman said, "Oh yeah, such and such, such and such." He said, "Well, how did it exactly go?" The rector said, "I'll change the name to avoid it. I'm the rector of St. Swithin's, you know, I think is what we have in this report." And the congressman said, "Oh yeah, St. Swithin's, you got a great nursing home there." And this is a school that actually is noted for having its architecture. I don't remember the guy's name. He's in the Portland region, a very famous architect, designed these buildings, and it's considered among architects a good example of this person's style. But even that's not enough to bring it as like a cultural asset. It still doesn't come to the attention of the community. So people again and again, both religious insiders and politicians and corporate leaders and so on, relayed that somehow religious leaders and their institutions have become kind of hidden. Some observers have suggested that religious leaders and institutions are victims of a social climate that is largely indifferent to religion. So they were a little bit sympathetic. One head of a very large foundation said to me that he thought part of this was not just a kind of marginalization of religion, but the shifting of cultural patterns in our society. And I think he may be onto something. By that he meant, with the democratization of our society and the multiculturalism and everybody needs to participate kind of idea, he said, there isn't a hierarchy of leadership anymore that automatically pushes certain people into a public leadership role. He said, in the days of the so-called tall steeple churches, everybody expected that minister would take a kind of public role. And if you got appointed to that, you thought you had to do that. But now that there's more of a level playing field in decision-making in society, he thought it was harder for churches to find their place. Others said that it was more kind of a marginalization thing. One woman, this was again in the philanthropic world, said she regularly tried to rotate the leadership of her board of directors among segments of her community. She would never have, say for example, somebody who was in the real estate industry chair her board for more than 3 years and wouldn't follow up with another person from the real estate industry. She'd make sure the person was from the financial industry or, you know, other corporate sector or private sector, so that it rotated around in all the aspects of the life of this city. But she said when we came to her and started raising these questions and asked her to be one of the people we interviewed, she started thinking about this and she realized that the last three chairs of her board had all been active members of the same church. Mm-hmm. They were different sectors of the other aspects of the community, but as a religious person, they're all same denomination, all leaders in the same congregation, not just the same denomination. And she said, you know, I guess religion doesn't play a very important role in figuring out how religious leadership happens, because I shouldn't do that. You know, I should make sure I've got somebody who's not only not a real estate guy, but not a real estate person who's Presbyterian and a member of Central Presbyterian in Atlanta. It should be a banker who's a Roman Catholic and a member of a parish on the other side of town or something like that. So if we were concerned about religion being a factor in the leadership and decision making. But what they said they regretted time and time again by the absence of religious institutions and religious leadership taking a more active role was what they thought was the wisdom resident in these communities and a willingness to raise the hard questions around the table when major issues were being discussed. They hoped that religious leaders would be there not to provide specific recommendations all the time, although if anybody was expert in something, they'd be happy to receive it. But what they regretted about the absence of religious leadership was the raising of the moral tone, was a phrase we heard a lot, and an expectation that religious communities and leaders would again hold everybody's feet to the fire to not come up with the cheap solutions, you know, or to avoid the really addressing the hard questions. But again, to raise the basic point of the study, when they tried to do that, they found that either A, there was an unwillingness to do so, and I mentioned earlier this week that when the governor of Louisiana tried to stop riverboat gambling from coming into Shreveport because he thought it was a solution to their economic problems on the cheap, that it wouldn't be a good long-term resolution to the decline of the oil industry in Shreveport, he started calling the Baptist Network. He thought surely he could get these guys in the Southern Baptist leadership to come out strongly against this gambling proposal. They wouldn't touch it. And so he said, forget it. If even the Baptists don't care, I don't care either. I'm not going to fight this in the state legislature, because there was already a majority lining up to do this. Whenever people look to this, they find people won't step up to the plate, or that they're not even really ready to if they're willing to consider it. Again, in another city, they brought all these church leaders and other prominently positioned religious leaders in one city together to help this one deal with this one issue and set up some other agendas. And the woman who was responsible for convening it said to me, they spent the whole time talking to each other. She said, they didn't even know who their colleagues were, let alone come in and sort of represent the religious voice on these matters. She said, the entire conference, she said, with these ministers and priests introducing themselves to each other. They spend all their time in their own churches, and they're not even ready to talk about taking on any kind of public role. She was scandalized. She said, this was in the philanthropic sector. She said, I know who run all the other foundations in this region. We have lunch now and then. She said, I couldn't believe it. These ministers didn't even know each other. So it's just a real missed connection.
Is that unusual that the ministers in a community don't know each other?
It's becoming we only have data from 4 cities. So I have to hasten to say, you know, this is a very exploratory study. As I said at the outset, we think what we found is probably the rule and not the exception, that there will be exceptions in many other areas. But we think that, again, this idea of taking care of your own has come to predominate, and that ministers and clergy will know other clergy, but in very discreet and small circles, intra-denominational stuff, not larger networks. It's very difficult. I think most ministers would say this if they've tried it, those who've tried it. It's very difficult to pull off interfaith alliances and so on.
Do you think some of that is because congregations demand so much of a minister's time when you own that person? Yeah. And that person is supposed to keep your family safe, keep your family educated, keep your family from being hurt or touched by the scary outside things. So that even if you go out and, you know, work, you know, and I know in Seattle we have a lot of work that goes on down in First Avenue and the missionaries and things like that, where people go work in the kitchens and that kind of thing, but it doesn't come to our house. Mm-hmm. My view of most of the churches and all of the denominations is that they just really want to know who their kids are with, and they want to know, you know, they've circled the wagons kind of emotionally.
Have the rest of you found that to be the case?
Not in our church, according to us. We're fortunate to have a pastor who's very politically aware and active, and he more or less challenges the congregation and encourages the congregation to get involved. And he sits on the board of some community action groups, and so he's inspirational in kind of keeping us all
actively. My church is in the First Ring suburb, and the churches did get together in interdenominational and to form a community action group, Interfaith Action. There's a similar group in St. Paul, and to look at the community, what are the needs of the First Ring suburbs primarily, because that's the city's moving out and changing.
This is why people are saying we need to go to Minneapolis, St. Paul to study the exception.
First thing we did was go out and visit the community. And the groups got together, got some training for the visitors. We went out 2x2. Mm-hmm. I went with a Roman Catholic and interviewed the community. Not talk about religion, but talk about, what's up with you? Mm-hmm. What are you interested in? Mm-hmm. And we did do some. Got active as far as promoting some legislation about reclaiming some land so that the business community could come in there and we could have new businesses that would provide good paying jobs to the people. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at some of the core issues. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, in the Tacoma area, I think there is that taking care of your own. As I mentioned to you, Daniel, clear back at the, in the 80s of the Iran hostage situation, an issue of just a united prayer vigil for those hostages. The 8 Episcopal congregations within Pierce County maintained a vigil for the whole time, sharing it, but extended that invitation to everybody, and the Baha'is came in for 1 6-hour block of time. We're the only ones that stepped over the threshold, and I think there's a couple of things that come in. In fact, the one is our clergy are generally so overwhelmed with the needs of their own congregation that it's difficult to go out, and then you throw styles of worship into the thing as well. And I know within our area there is a rather minimal effort of the downtown churches that all are facing a similar dilemma of congregations that are living 10, 20, 30 miles away from the physical facility because they've gone to the suburbs, that they have tried to do some things together, but it's pretty minimal. And when you get away from that core 6 or 8 downtown congregations to try and do anything, the only thing that I have seen is when two individual congregations for some reason make a connection. The clergy of the two, the vestries of the two group, you know, whatever, that they're or something, but it's very focused.
Mm-hmm. There was a good bit of discussion among corporate and business leaders and political leaders that of sympathy for the clergy, not so much a sense of maybe a pressure from parishioners to be busy with our families, but a perception of the complications of running any nonprofit corporation these days. That particularly business leaders would repeatedly say, I don't know what I would do if I had to get all the money together that most ministers had to get together just to keep those old buildings up and running, was the phrase we heard a lot. That the costs involved in management issues involved of holding together a place like a church was perceived to be kind of all-consuming, and they could understand why. Between the obviously primary duties of a minister, adding to that what they thought were the complications of keeping the institution up and running, they could understand why it was difficult to devote much energy to public leadership. But at the same time, they also said, and this was mostly from business leaders, interestingly enough, they faulted part of it was that what they thought was a declining quality of the talent of people going into the ministry. If somebody ordained, you know, just kind of cuts right, you know, stick it in. I told this one CEO of a corporation in Atlanta, I said, just drive it in real, just hit it again one more time. And it, for the first time, I also heard, because I had never heard this, They laid it partly just in general, and I could tell them that from other studies I've participated in, there's some objective evidence for this. One, higher education, it's measuring talent, you know, is a very, obviously, a big, big difficult thing, but a guy named Jack Schuster, who's a important fellow in higher education studies out in the Claremont Graduate School, went in and tracked the vocational preferences of Rhodes Scholars and members of Phi Beta Kappa, two hallmarks of intellectual capacity. Not the whole story of talents needed for the ministry, obviously, but they checked those. And they were checking for in general, not just for ministry. From the late 40s into the present, and those who went into the so-called helping professions, including teaching or social work or the ministry, declined from about, I think it's 17% or so of that pool down to 2% between over those decades. Whereas those going into business, medicine, and law, the curve went like this. So there's some objective evidence. But the interesting twist on this that I had never heard was they questioned the second career expansion of the pool by the seminaries. They said in their experience that they thought probably opening up seminaries to the so-called second career clergy was a good thing on many counts, and probably many talented people entered. But in their experience, most of the people they ran into seemed to be people who just couldn't cut it in other occupations, so they thought they'd take an easy job where the expectations were low and the accountability was almost non-existent. You could be in a church and people might not like you, but there's really very little accountability where people, you could really be fired or called on the carpet, that sort of thing. So they really questioned the second career thing. And I had never heard of that, because all of the rhetoric about second career I always heard was, this is a way to improve the quality of the ministry, because you're going to get people out there with life experience who've decided to make it, weren't just kind of going in as a young person trying to find their way, but somebody who after some real adult living was ready to make a real commitment to the ministry and would bring all this life experience, as I said. But they thought, they just saw people taking an easy way out with a nice secure job. Maybe it pays not very well, but you know, you get a house and nobody's going to fire you. And you got a good pension plan. I don't know. So they had both sympathy and criticism. But I didn't hear so much about the demands of the local church.
Well, I have to think about, you know, our son Peter's graduating from college this year, and he was home at one point and a pastor friend of ours was visiting, and he was doing his job of trying to recruit young men for the ministry, and or young people for the ministry, and he was trying to talk to Peter and saying, you know, Peter, why, you know, you're have a philosophy major, you're talking about going to graduate school, why don't you want to think about going to the seminary? And they went back and forth all evening, and Peter was getting increasingly frustrated with his friend. And then finally Peter said, it just doesn't seem to me that the church is effective enough. You know, now that kind of rips marks of my heart out, you know.
And yeah, he said he wanted to find a career that had a bigger impact, where he could have a bigger impact on society by doing something else.
You know, I guess so that's what we showing, you know, this is a kid who grew up in what I think is an active church, you know, and he still can't see it. It's kind of scary to me. I talked to the bishop of our synod one day, and I said, so are any of your three children considering going into the ministry? And he kind of looked down at the floor and said, no.
Well, don't you think churches are kind of have personalities, and they are kind of internally, I mean, that's how they stick together. I mean, that's, and you need that in order to stick together as a group, and you become, you have personality. I mean, if I look at the churches in my neighborhood, regardless of what type of church it is, they all have personalities, you know. They're the fun Presbyterians. and the one Lutheran church that's also fun, and then there's another Lutheran church that is just all dear, and you have to tithe 10% or you can't go there and be a member. You know, and I mean, they all have their little personalities.
That is
but
true.
But they need that to exist.
Mm. Yeah, that is true too. But all of these people we interviewed were hopeful, you know. They really thought if this could all just be called to everybody's attention, that this missing connection could be put back together. Now, you were saying some of this has been happening in your area. If you think if the rest of you would agree that it's lacking in this, in our country, or would you share the hopefulness of these people? Or do you think they were just being kind to us? Thought they should tell us interviewers that they looked forward to this changing and thought it would and could.
I think you have to have a need. Like it seems like in St. Paul, there's a need, and everybody felt a need to do it. And in my neighborhood, no one would feel the need.
So there's no debated public question in your community.
Well, no, I don't, not that I'm aware of. I mean, I think they're real happy being in the individual groups, you know, and that's their identity. It's their, I live in West Seattle, and people there will decide to secede from the city every now and then because they're really annoyed with it. I mean, you
well,
know,
that would be a pretty important public
and
issue.
So they might, around that issue, and we've also had some housing zoning changes that people bond around, but I don't think that the churches, but people do come together for those political issues, but I don't.
I was thinking too, there are some issues that polarize the different church congregations. I had one recently where the town built a new library funded with public money, and the library board had chosen some artists' etched glass of the muses, by this, I think it was from Greek mythology, as a centerpiece of the entry to the library. And some of the fundamentalist congregations immediately voiced opposition for introducing
paganism
and cult representation into the
music. Scary thing.
Yeah, and so they started this opposition movement. And then some of the other congregations, more church leaders or pastors, came out in favor of the artistic expression and the open ability to express different views. So we had kind of a split in the religious community over the artwork for the library. They found a compromise solution. They kept the artwork, but they moved it from the entry of the building and used it as kind of a raised panel thing up near the ceiling. Where it's not
so prominent.
Yeah. You don't have to look. They could change the figures. Originally, they were the Greek goddesses. There was I remember we had the one Buddhist that's in the county show up at one of the meetings.
And what was that person's opinion?
And he said, well, it doesn't offend me. And I mean, the figures were representing different cultures, actually, around the world. You know, I mean, they brought it in. So it wasn't all just Greek mythology. They were bringing in an American Indian type thing, you know, Indian Indian type thing, and the, you know, the goddess with all the arms and oh my God, ugly.
Yeah,
I mean,
I have
never seen such ugly letters to the editor in our little paper about how we were evil.
See, the great irony in that is that exactly what these public leaders in this report hoped that religious communities would provide, namely raising the moral tone, not in the sense of a specific morality, I guess you would say, but raising that religion's leaders would provide a moral tone in the sense of making public decision-making civil rather than uncivil, and that it would provide a call to deal with hard questions, but again, in a civil matter, in a civil way. I think the people still hold out the hope that religion will do that, despite the fact that historically religious communities have been the source of much rancor. The abortion issue being the classic example of not being able to discuss something in a public and civil manner. I think largely it's because people are not buying my proposal, and let me repeat it, that the way for churches to be engaged in public theology, to do public theology, is not to do it by being personally formed in your convictions, and then whenever, and then you go out as an individual and tell the rest of society what should be done, because you've learned the truth and you're now going to report it out on behalf of the Lord God Almighty. And classically, pastors, ministers have done that because they are, of course, are the exemplars of the morally formed and educated and committed and true believer Christians. So they go out and do the kind of, I'm going to be a politically involved minister and go out and, if whatever your conviction is, rail against Venus or whoever, or the muses etched in glass in some town, or whatever the case may be. And that's when sometimes local communities complain because they don't share that individual pastor's interests. My concern would be that churches and religious communities not abandon their ethical convictions, but that they also, in addition to having those ethical convictions amongst their members, train their members not only to be individually people who believe these things, but learn how to talk about them together and know how to form themselves not just as individual believers, but as a community of believers, which of course involves talking about and discussing these things. And then, as a step beyond that, they develop, take this ethical procedural ethic that they've learned to develop themselves as a moral community, not just as moral individuals, and make that an occasion for discussing the broader issues out in the community and find ways to bring others into that procedural, that ethical procedure of discourse, where that local community, religious community, say my church, will clearly put its perspective on the table without doubting that at all, but it will be put on the table in what I'm calling this ethical procedural ethic of civil discussion and discourse, that others are invited to bring their point of view as well. Churches are starting to do that. Some congregations are doing it. It's happening around, but we need to expand it. Yes.
I was just wondering, what would you see as the end result of that discussion? What would it be like, looking for a consensus opinion or a compromise, or just an awareness of each other's viewpoint?
This is an incredibly... No, I do think decisions need to come from it, but this is an incredibly, in many ways, optimistic and naive view. It's rooted. If we had another week, we could start to build what are the actual, from certain traditions, theological justifications for this. From the Lutheran heritage, it's this notion of what's called evangelical freedom. That is, if you just give Christians the permission to exercise the freedom they have in the gospel to hang out together, the right things will happen. The Lutheran tradition doesn't have canon law. It doesn't have certain built-in hierarchies of decision-making. It's built on this very optimistic, naive assumption that if you preach the gospel, that the church will be properly gathered and assembled. If the gospel is purely preached and the sacraments rightly administered, then these Christians will just gather and do their thing. And this is, from a Lutheran perspective, an extension of that. From Reformed traditions and Presbyterian and Episcopal heritage, notions of the that are shared out of from the Lutheran tradition as well, but of vocation and calling, your call to come together to see whatever you're doing makes a contribution. It's ultimately a faith, as I've argued this week, in what I called last night the American dream. This democratic ideal will work, that if people are allowed to come together and is committed to our procedural democracy, where we gather simply around the principles of freedom, equality, and mutual respect, that the nation will be able to make its decisions and will hold together. Classically, global cultures have said, you can't do that. Erasmus, an intellectual leader of the late Middle Ages in the Reformation era, told Luther, you can't tell them this faith alone, gospel freedom stuff. Nobody will do what is right. You gotta give them rules. You know, that was his argument against the Reformation.
Wasn't he a founder of humanism?
Yes. Yeah, he said you can't do, you still gotta have these rules. People won't do what's right. Global cultures have said you can't do this democratic thing. People always, inevitably, revolutions tend to occur and they say they're gonna be democratic, but they back away into some other forced, coerced, common culture. Got to have common religion, common rules, certain respect of this or that. They look at us and say, look at that chaos. Look at how those children act in America. They're allowed to run wild. I mean, that's, you know, the democracy leads to chaos. Our view has been, historically in this country, both religiously and geopolitically, that if you allow these procedural democratic principles rooted, we think, as Christians in the idea of the freedom of the Christian person to prevail, that it'll work out, you know? And so far it has. The question is, these days, can we keep at it in our new multicultural setting is the next major challenge to these basic principles. And a lot of people are starting to back away. And we're seeing it in, you know, kind of gated community stuff, all sorts of new structures of that we can't trust these principles anymore because we've pushed it as far as we can now. We can't bring in more. You know? And that's the question, you know, can we do it?
Well, when you did your survey, did you find any denomination more willing than another to...
No.
They're all the same.
Yeah, we touched various major religious traditions and, you know, leaders in various... Many of the leaders that we ended up interviewing were active in religious communities, even though we were interviewing them in their secular roles. By virtue of our networks of connection, if our study is flawed in any way, we talked to a lot of politicians and CEOs and people like that who also happen to be very active Christians and so on. So we may have some dilemmas there. But in fact, in the end, we think it helped our study. But no, there's no particular slice of the religious community or secular community that saw this issue differently.
How do you deal with the fundamentalist Christian community that would see these ideas as a threat, you know, by kind of watering down the scriptures and allowing for secularism?
Well, if it weren't already 11:45, we could talk about that. But I we do need to close here. But it's just again another aspect of the kind of individual, not including a procedural ethic in their ethic. You know, they think there's a certain ethical view of things, and you go out and tell the truth. And that's commonplace in religious communities, not just fundamentalist communities.
Yeah.
But what it brings up for me, all of this, is the need for finding people, or if you can train people in the church leaders to be able to lead something like this. You know, you can't go into something, you know, you could have the fundamentalist communities even come in if you had a skilled leader being able to say, well, yes, okay, that's what you're saying, and these were these, and so, you know, somebody who can moderate this whole thing, and that's not an easy thing to do. You know, you have to be able to come in there and put your own kind of aside and not feel defensive or personalize it. And, you know, and that's where the glitch is going to come in. Just as the seminaries don't teach you how to do spaghetti dinners for 150, as you found out when you went to your first parish, how do you do this? You know, they don't, it doesn't seem to me that they're creating, leaders in this way.
But it's also, I think, the success of this cannot be dependent on the clergy.
Right, absolutely.
And this is the reason why the other side of my proposal that we haven't talked about as much this week is that I think, in addition to fostering this, getting congregations to make a commitment to this kind of device, religious communities have to be creating what I was calling, for lack of a better term, more institutes or study centers or organizations where the laity who are willing to do this kind of work or who have talents around specific issues in our society today can come together, work on both the procedures and substantive points of these issues, and become kind of think tanks that are available as resources. We should have them all around the country. I think we need these more than we need the networks of lobbying offices that we created. They're helpful too, but we really need these centers where people who are willing to take some time to work on these kinds of things can come together and be resources for this sort of thing. We need this in addition to local congregational leadership. The kind of thing that I'm talking about is happening in select congregations and churches around the country, especially some bigger churches. The institute side of it isn't taking off, although there are some models for that as well.
The willingness, to me, is the single area of great decline that is affecting this whole thing. The willingness to step forward and take some leadership role. The willingness to volunteer within your community. I'm involved in the fire service, and the number of volunteers that are out there. The service organization, the Lions Club in my own little community has been active for years, and they're dwindling down to, and that lack of willingness to step up and do something more than just for me.
Yeah. So again, the first step is the congregation remembering their job is not just to train people as good individuals with good character, but to persons that also understand the notion of
community.
And communal moral formation. We've got to get back to doing that. Well, thanks for coming in lieu of discussing the play.